All right. Welcome to the Creation Science Hour. This is Jonathan Sampson here this August 5th, my older brother's birthday, and he has no idea that I'm announcing it on the air right now. So I need to call him later on and wish him happy birthday. This is the Creation Science Hour. Again, this is Jonathan Sampson here in Pensacola, Florida, at the Ministry of Creation Science Evangelism, where we do this daily program, weekdays, 5 days a week, something like that, for about an hour and a half a day, where we talk about creation, evolution, dinosaurs, and the Bible. And I just happen to have in front of me, this makes it official, a bobblehead dinosaur, bouncing around, looking left and right, kind of redundant. So that makes this official. We are officially the place for your answers. And today, unfortunately, Dr. Hovind is not with us. Now, for those of you out there listening who are saying, well, who is Dr. Hovind? Dr. Hovind, about 16 years ago, started the Ministry of Creation Science Evangelism. He was a public school teacher, Christian school teacher, high school level, so forth. Science, math, all that great stuff that we just absolutely love, because I know you guys love that stuff. Yeah, some of us. Anyway, some of us don't. I recall high school. The nightmares. Anyway, we're on this program today, because Dr. Hovind's not here, we're going to be listening to one of his debates. He's participated in well over 90 debates. He's spoken in well over 30 countries. I didn't know 30 countries existed until I found that out. But, let alone, he's been in almost all of them. Spoken in just about, I think, all 50 states, the United States of America. And the debates are actually one of the most hot topics, I'd say. I mean, people just absolutely love watching the debates. The atheists, the evolutionists, aren't so threatened by watching them because they got one of their own guys up there defending the idea that, well, it all happened by chance over millions and billions of years. And there was no designer. And if there was a designer, then it's some blind, random designer, bottom-up tinkerer, as Michael Shermer said from Skeptic Magazine. I guess that would make some sense, a little bit of bottom-up tinkerer. But that's not what we see out there. We see some amazing design. So, regardless of say, we're going to be listening to this debate today between Dr. Matthew Rainbow, a professor of biology out at Antelope Valley College, and Dr. Kent Hovind, our own on-staff scientist here, the guy who is in well demand, I mean great demand, to speak all over the world in many different languages. He only speaks one, but he usually has someone help him out. So without further ado, I'm going to start this video. And again, you guys, if you have any comments, questions, love notes, or anything like that, or you just want to, you know, talk about the video, you can send your questions over AOL Instant Messenger. Dr. Dino Live is our screen name here in the office. It's DrDinoLive. And we would love to hear from you. If your stuff is cool enough, we might even just read it on the air. We'll stop the video and read it. We'll put everything on hold and put you up on a pedestal. So here we go. Without further ado, this is a debate between Dr. Matthew Rainbow and Dr. Kent Hovind. In a second. John Gusty over here, he's our tech guy. He's actually the staff artist saying it's not a video, it's the audio. But for me, it's a video. I have special privileges. Do you see this, John? Okay, so here we go. Professor of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, Antelope Valley College, Mr. Matthew Rainbow, will open us up, I believe. The great debate, creation versus evolution. In a second. Oh, there we go.
Professor there at Antelope Valley College, holds a bachelor's degree in biochemistry and molecular biology from UC Santa Barbara, master's degree in education from Claremont Graduate School, PhD in molecular biology and biochemistry from UC Irvine. And he was a former creationist. He believed in the biblical account of creation, and through his study over a period of time came to believe that that was not consistent with the way things are, and has since become a proponent of evolution, and has certainly taught this, and I'm not sure if he's ever debated before in this kind of a forum, but certainly on more of an individual basis. But he is a friend of mine. We've gone to lunch several times, and I enjoy him as a person. Certainly don't agree with some of his views, but I respect him as a man, and have many interesting conversations over lunch. So I'd like for you to welcome Dr. Rainbow Stevens.
The crowd in attendance is insane. Hundreds and hundreds of people all clapping for Mr. Rainbow. He is a very nice guy. And, okay, I'll shut up. I'll go back to it.
Dr. Kent Hovind taught high school science for about 15 years. and then went on to get involved in this ministry that he's involved in now of teaching creation science, not only in places like this. He's debated many, many times, has written all kinds of material, tapes, videos, and all these things, and also got a PhD in education, and he speaks about 700 times a year in forums like this, and he'll speak anywhere, anytime. If he's there, he loves to keep busy, and we've enjoyed him here at this church this weekend, and I would like for you to welcome Dr. Hovind from Pensacola, Florida. He is. Okay, the clock is beginning. We'll first turn it over to Dr. Rainbow, and thank you for coming.
Good evening. I'm going to begin by thanking my friend, Pastor Dave Prather, and the members of Central Christian for inviting me here tonight to your beautiful church. Although I am not a Christian or a regular churchgoer, I do attend church occasionally at various places in Lancaster with my sons, and have found that I enjoy coming here to Central Christian perhaps more than anywhere else on Sunday mornings. I have met many wonderful people here and have felt very welcome. It's a great honor and a pleasure for me to have been invited to address tonight's important topic, and I feel especially honored to share a podium with Dr. Kent Hovind, who is an eminent and well-known expert in the field of scientific creationism and who I have had the great pleasure of getting to know in preparation for tonight's debate. This guy totally stole my kids' hearts, teaching them how to make paper airplanes and shoot rubber bands. I'm going to have trouble competing with him as a father figure from now on. Okay, now if we can go ahead and get my... there we go. My talk tonight is called What Scientific Evidence Is There for Evolution? Then with a special emphasis on how to be a Christian and think properly about the theory of evolution. Okay, here's a fascinating and ironic fact about the United States of America. The United States is the most technologically and scientifically advanced nation on the planet, the envy of the rest of the world for our research and development infrastructure, as well as our university education system. Yet in the U.S., approximately half the population reject out of hand the most important scientific principle in all of biology, which is the theory of evolution. Now let's begin by asking, what's at stake in the creation-evolution controversy? Let's ask, why do evolutionists fight so hard to defend the theory? First, evolution is the central unifying principle of modern biology. Theodosius Dobzhansky, one of the three most famous evolutionists of the 20th century, and a Christian, I might add, a Russian Orthodox Christian, said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution," and I would heartily agree with that. Two, evolution is an aesthetically beautiful theory with grand and awesome themes. Some evolutionists, including myself, believe that evolution profoundly glorifies God. Some evolutionists use the theory to support an atheistic natural philosophy and argue against the very existence of God, which they have a right to do, just as Christians have a right to argue for the existence of God. Okay, why do creationists abhor the theory of evolution? It seems to make no scientific sense whatsoever. It's a calculated attempt to destroy belief in God and to render the concept of a creator obsolete. It contradicts the book of Genesis and therefore stands in mortal opposition to Scripture. It teaches that humans are descended from animals and therefore destroys all basis for morality. And it glorifies death. Now, I've been asked to present the scientific evidence for evolution to an audience which, though personally friendly, is to a large degree intellectually hostile to the subject in a mere 40 minutes. This is a daunting task. In tonight's debate, I bear the burden of proof. I must show that there is compelling evidence for the theory of evolution. I think I do a pretty good job of that every semester in my biology classes at AV College, but there I have almost 50 hours to lay the necessary background and explain the theory. My having agreed to do it tonight in a mere 40 minutes to a conceptually hostile audience borders on lunacy. I hope you realize how difficult a task I face. I have to try to explain one of the most counterintuitive ideas ever encountered by humans. The idea that physical systems of staggering complexity and design can arise spontaneously through the mere operation of the normal laws of physics and chemistry in only 40 minutes. Pray for me. Now, since I have only 40 minutes in a formal presentation, I cannot talk about everything and I cannot talk to everybody. So I have decided to talk pretty much to just one group of people, the creationists. I'm going to place myself in their frame of reference and assume that a creator of some sort does exist, which I personally suspect is true but am not sure about. I am technically an agnostic, which means I do not know if God exists. But tonight, with your permission, I will talk pretty much as if I were a full-fledged theist, since I am trying to operate tonight from within the Christian frame of reference, which I respect. So remember, I am not a Christian, but I used to be a Christian, and it is not impossible that I might become a Christian again someday. I do not want anyone to think that I'm trying to be deceptive or trying to pull the wool over people's eyes, or still worse, that I'm some sort of spirit of darkness masquerading as an angel of light. So in my talk, I will be explicitly speaking to the Christians in the audience who are creationists. All the rest of you, the evolutionists of various persuasions, the atheists, the agnostics, you're formally invited to eavesdrop in on this conversation that I will be having with the creationists. Now, some creationists take considerable offense at the suggestion. By the way, we could go ahead. Can we turn on the slides, please? Oh, okay. What do I hit again? Oh, the top. Okay. So some creationists take... By the way, I'm going to read from a prepared text because I have an extremely complex talk tonight with a lot of animations and slides, and if I get out of sync with my technology, I'm cooked. So bear with me here. So for the third time, sorry, some creationists take offense at the suggestion that humans have evolved from ape-like ancestors. Allow me now to make a rather aggressive point about that, a point which will also lead naturally into some of the necessary molecular biology that we must talk about tonight. So here's the point. If you're in some sense insulted by the idea that you are descended from animals, then you must really be insulted by Genesis 3:19, which says you are descended from dirt. Genesis says you are descended from Adam, and Adam, whose very name in Hebrew is a pun in the Hebrew on the word for clay, Adam was made from the dust of the ground, which is, let's face it, dirt. In the very earthy account of creation found in Genesis 2 and 3, it says, "Then Yahweh formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being."
But you see, the problem here is that man formed the dust of the earth into man, or God formed the dust of the earth into man. And so it doesn't matter if we came from dust or not. It came from God's hand. Now, the alternative to that is evolution says that man also came from the ground, but by itself, over chance, you know, over billions of years. And so there's a very big difference there. God can take dirt and make man, but dirt can't take itself and make anything.
So in regard to your origins, you have two options. You can embrace evolutionary theory, which says that time plus dirt equals humans, or you can embrace a literal interpretation of Genesis 2, which says that God plus dirt equals humans. In either case, we recognize a fact common to creationism and evolutionism, which is that we are dirt. In other words, we all recognize that our bodies and the bodies of all living things, interestingly enough, are made of non-living atoms.
And we're going to cut it right there for the break. Stay tuned. Tell your friends right now, truthradio.com. We'll be right back.
millions of people in Southeast Asia. December 26th will never be forgotten. The tsunami that hit 11 countries devastated millions of lives that will take decades to rebuild. Lifeline, America's most trusted Christian telecom company, has another way for you to help. No, we're not asking for donations. We're simply asking you to take what you already use, long-distance service, and put your phone bill to work, changing lives. Call Lifeline now. Switch your service. Get the lowest rates like 2.9 cents per minute and help places such as Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand while the doors are open so wide. At Lifeline, we donate a portion of your phone bill to relief ministries that you choose, and we've been doing it for almost 15 years.
Phone 1-800-311-2418. Your participation with Lifeline will help.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance. This nation is asking for action, and action now.
Not many people who know what Franklin Delano Roosevelt was really about respected his administration. But you have to give him credit for really laying it on the line back then in the 30s in a way that applies today. Nothing to fear but fear itself. What's this about terror? If you want this kind of information to get deeper into American society, support Truth Radio. Our address is P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, zip code 93444. P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, zip code 93444.
And welcome back to Soft Talk Radio. No, I'm just playing. This is Creation Science Evangelism, the Creation Science Hour. This is Jonathan Sampson here in Pensacola, Florida. We're listening right now to a debate between Dr. Matthew Rainbow, who is a biochemist over at Antelope Valley College. Cantaloupe, that's really good. Antelope Valley College, though. He's debating our very own Dr. Ken Hovind, and they're about maybe 5-10 minutes into the debate. So we're going to pick up right where we were leaving off with Dr. Rainbow. And again, if you guys have any questions, comments, criticisms, or anything like that, send it right now over Dr. Dino Live, the screen name, on AOL Instant Messenger. On AOL Instant Messenger, the screen name is Dr. Dino Live, DrDinoLive, and tell us what you're thinking. So without further ado, here's Mr. Matthew Rainbow.
I am a biochemist and molecular biologist by training, and I make my living by studying and teaching students about the fact that all living things are made of normal atoms, which obey all the laws of physics and chemistry. From a physical point of view, our bodies are marvelous machines. Here, for example, is a computer-generated image of the atoms in a protein molecule. And then here is a similar image of the atoms in the DNA double helix. By the way, I wouldn't mind having the lights down just a little more, Ryan. In fact, fairly dark. I'm a graphical purist here. Can we turn them down a little bit? Oh, okay. Well, can everybody see okay? All right. So it has been proven over and over through tens of thousands of controlled scientific experiments that living things are literally machines, constantly obeying all the laws of physics and chemistry. No modern educated person, including creationists, disputes this raw, intriguing fact that from a physical point of view, we are machines. The central question that Dr. Hovind and I are here to address tonight is simply this: how did these machines get here? Now, one of the songs that you sing here in this church, and I have actually sung it with you, putting my own personal spin on the meaning of it, one of the songs you sing has the lyric, "Our God is an awesome God." Tonight, I'm going to try to expose you to an idea which, if true, means that God as the Creator is even more awesome than you think. Near the end of the 18th century, an English doctor of divinity and professor at Cambridge University, the Reverend William Paley, wrote a seminal work in the history of creationism entitled Evidences of Christianity. In this work, Paley created a memorable image. He said that if you're walking on a heath and hit his phone up to put on a stone, he might inquire how it came to be there, but would be able to say little about it. Indeed, the stone might have been laying there forever for all he knew. But, he said, suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. In that case, he argued, we would come to a very different conclusion. Since the watch is made of many intricate parts, which work perfectly together for a single purpose and display a remarkable unified design, he could only conclude that there was a designer responsible for the existence of the watch. Paley went on to explain that in nature we find countless living creations far more intricate than a watch. For example, the design of the eye with its lens and many other parts is staggering to behold. Everywhere he looked, at an oyster, a spoonbill bird, a human kidney, Paley found evidence that nature had a designer. Paley's book was required reading for the young aspiring naturalists and theologians who were in college at Cambridge, and it was particularly inspiring to this student, who we will meet again in a moment. This young man was an Orthodox Christian, excited about biology and what it taught him about his creator. And he not only read, but even memorized parts of Paley's book. Now, Paley's lesson is really a point about...
Just to fill you all in right there, he was showing a picture of Charles Darwin in the background. So, that's who he's talking about. This young man is Charles Darwin.
Engineering. I'm sure we have many engineers in the audience tonight, since this valley builds the most sophisticated aircraft in the world. Engineers have always taken a great interest in the creation-evolution debate, partly because evolutionary theory tends to come across as complete and utter nonsense to many engineers. Since both special creation and evolution can be considered forms of engineering, one divine and the other natural, I'm now going to make a point about the engineering of living things. Here's a slide of a fruit fly embryo developing. Now, we all know that whenever something is created by engineers, it always goes through four phases of development. The first phase is the conceptual phase, during which actual drawings and blueprints of the machine are made up, which will then guide the upcoming design phase, during which... We had the conceptual phase, the design phase, drawing up blueprints and so forth, which will then guide the upcoming assembly phase, during which the device is painstakingly constructed piece by piece according to the carefully made design. Now, after the machine has been constructed, if all has gone well, the engineers now get to power up the machine with its source of energy, turn it on, and watch it work. They are now in the phase which engineers live for, namely the operational phase. Now, in the creation of a machine, if it has been well conceived, designed, and assembled, there will always come a time when the engineer can take his hands off the machine and step back and let the machine run on its own. Think of a computer automatically running programs, rendering graphics, carrying out calculations while its operator sits back in the chair and drinks a soda. Or think of the autopilot on a jetliner, which is automatically landing the aircraft in a dense fog as the pilot and co-pilot simply watch the instrument panel with their hands folded. Or think of a robot spot welding parts of a car on an assembly line while no human watches it at all. It's obvious that the most impressive machines of all are machines that run on their own without any further intervention. Such machines are very complex and hard to design, and when the engineers who made them finally come to the, what I'll call, the step back and hands off point, it's an awesome sight to behold. Now, living things, as we have said, are complex assemblies of atoms and molecules which obey all the normal laws of physics and chemistry. That is to say, they are literally machines. Creationism and evolutionism have different ways of explaining how those machines arose. In fundamentalist Christian creationism, it is believed that God made the first representatives of all the major kinds of living things, quote, out of the ground, that is from earth or clay or dirt or whatever you prefer to call that. That is to say, God made living things piece by piece from normal atoms, including hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, phosphorus, sulfur, manganese, magnesium, zinc, iron, and one more, copper, that green atom right in the middle, that cytochrome C oxidase, the protein you have in your body that's literally carrying electricity in the mitochondria of your cells. It's got a copper atom in the middle, so forth and so on. So other atoms that were present in the earth contributed to this, presumably, and God presumably assembled them into fantastic arrays to make DNA double helices and beta pleated sheets and proteins and electron transport chains and mitochondria and so forth, much like Paley's watchmaker might assemble a watch piece by piece from its components, springs, gears, and levers. It would be an awesome sight to behold. That would have been a tremendous thing to see that happen in Genesis 2. But now consider what the theory of evolution asserts. Evolution says that atoms and molecules present in deep space and then on the primitive Earth did something radically different from what is described in Genesis 2. Over vast stretches of time, the atoms, through a process which is only partially understood, but which I will try to tell you a lot about tonight, did the astonishing thing of self-assembling into living things. I want you to think hard about this. Imagine that you knew a watch designer who was so incredibly skilled at what he did that he could design the parts of a watch, make the parts, throw them out on a table, and then step back and take his hands off, watching while the hundreds of parts of the watch put themselves together before your eyes. Would that be unbelievable? Or imagine that one day you're conversing with a friend who works at the Skunk Works, where the world's most advanced aircraft have been designed and produced. And he says to you, guess what? We just made a new type of aircraft the world has never seen before, and it's just been declassified, and I can tell you about it. You say, what is it, a new generation of stealth aircraft? And he says, yes, but that's not what is truly new about it. You say, well, what is so new about it? And he says, it's an aircraft that's self-assembled from component parts.
No, they don't actually have that. But we will stop right here and come right back with Dr. Matthew Rainbow. And then shortly thereafter, go to Dr. Ken Hope and tell your friends to tune in to truthradio.com.
Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1798 on this piece of paper scotch taped here on the wall above my desk. 1798, after one of his own defeats, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "A little patience and we shall see the reign of witches pass over, their spells dissolve, and the people, recovering their true sight, restore their government to its true principles. If the game runs sometimes against us at home, we must have patience till luck turns, and then we shall have an opportunity of winning back the principles we have lost. For this is a game where principles are at stake," said Thomas Jefferson.
And that's the voice of Garrison Keillor, PrairieHome.org.
Tune with www.truthradio.com. You may at times find us elsewhere, but always www.truthradio.com. That's where we live. We visit other places, but this is where we always are. Stay tuned.
Let me ask you, would you go to
a fast food restaurant for filet mignon and lobster, then why do you bother going to a politician for a solution to your problems based upon morality? Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I read that in a letter to the editor, and I think it was worth passing on. And I would like to challenge your thinking to spend less time pleading with your congresspeople and more time getting people, your friends and others, to listen to Truth Radio. We need to build the audience for Truth Radio, and you can help through your emails, a brief reference to Truth Radio, through your conversations with friends, handing out little cards with Truth Radio mentioned. We appreciate all the help you can give. Thank you for listening, and bring along others with you.
Oh, yeah, gotta love the music. All right, welcome back to the Creation Science Hour again. This is August 5th, Brad's birthday. Brad's my brother. I'm Jonathan Sampson, the co-host here of the Creation Science Hour, our host and world-famous creation evolution lecturer, Dr. Kent Hovind, is not in attendance today, unfortunately. But he is in Tampa, Florida. So if you guys are in the Tampa area, get on our website, drdiner.com, find out where he's speaking, and get over there. I mean, he'll show you cool things about how to shoot a rubber band like 100 feet or something like that. You could take down a water buffalo from 50 yards with one of those things. And how to shoot a paper airplane about 400 feet. The cool stuff you'll learn at one of the Kent Hovind seminars. Anyway, we're going to get back on topic here. We're getting off on a tangent. We were listening to a debate between Dr. Matthew Rainbow, who is a biochemist at Antelope Valley College. There we go. And Dr. Kent Hovind here, who is our staff expert on creation, evolution, dinosaurs, and the Bible. And so we're going to get right back into that. And I think it's going to bring us right back in where Matthew Rainbow is talking. And yeah, it is. And again, if you guys have any comments, questions, or just ideas, anything you're screaming and ripping at your hair to say, you can do it right now over AOL Instant Messenger. It's Dr. Dino Live is our screen name, DrDinoLive. So without further ado, here is Matthew Rainbow.
You, if you know anything at all about engineering, would look at him like he was pulling your leg. And then when you saw he was serious, your jaw would slowly start to drop to the floor because you would know he had gone insane. You know that humans cannot yet build truly complex machines that put themselves together. We can make some machines, like robot welders on assembly lines, that can do simple things in the assembly of other machines, but we cannot even come close to making machines that assemble themselves. But guess who can make machines that assemble themselves? Now do you see why evolutionists get so excited?
Now, keep in mind that was kind of an odd bit of silence right there. Some thinking time or something that Matthew Rainbow has given us. He is arguing as a theistic evolutionist. He is not a theist. He's not a Christian. He said he used to be, and there's a chance maybe he will be in the future, but right now he's not. However, he said he's talking to the Christians, and more specifically the creationists, younger creationists in the audience, so he's arguing from the position of a theistic evolutionist. So don't get it confused here and say, oh, this guy's just religiously minded. He's an evolutionist. He's not a theist. But he's arguing from that position to try and convince us, the young earth creationists, Bible believers, Bible thumpers to some of you guys. So here we go.
About evolution? Think about this a little more from an engineering point of view again. In normal engineering, where does the step back and hands off point come in the process? Let me get my laser pointer here. There's my wallet. I'm glad I've still got that. Okay, where does the step back and hands-off point come in the process? The engineers have to have their minds and their hands intimately involved in the conceptual phase, the design phase, and the assembly phase. It is only during the operational phase, assuming everything goes well, that the engineers can step back and hands off. What evolutionary theory allows us to entertain as theists is the idea that Almighty God is creating life on Earth, has done something that will set your mind reeling and staggering, something as high above our own engineering abilities as the heavens are high above the Earth, something beyond all that we could ask or think. God has pushed the step back and hands off point, which was here, where? He's pushed the step back point into the assembly phase. This is the view of God that theistic evolutionists carry around in their heads. God as the creator is even more awesome than you think. They believe that God, with an intelligence that is nothing less than terrifying, has designed the fundamental particles of the universe and ordained the laws of quantum mechanics so that they will, over time, spontaneously self-assemble into living creatures, while he simply sits back and watches it happen. And then, after 12 billion years of cosmic evolution, when the first humans on the African savanna look up at the night sky and stare at the God, which their explosively large cerebral cortex can now sense is there, in an attitude of awe and primitive worship, and God stares right back. Let's look at another picture that helps us understand how God chooses to operate if the theory of evolution is correct. Here we have a representation of all that exists in the physical universe, which is called nature, derived from a word which conveys the meaning of being born, and from which we get other words like nativity and natal. Now, in addition to the physical universe, which is detectable with the five senses or with extensions of our five senses, many, and I dare say most of the people in the world, believe that there is another realm of existence that cannot normally be detected with the five senses, which is beyond nature or above nature. The word for above or beyond is super. So this is the supernatural or supernatural realm. And here we see God. Now please don't laugh at my picture of God, but God has chosen to ordain certain natural laws which govern the behavior of matter and energy in the physical universe. God seems to really enjoy using natural laws, since virtually everything obeys God's natural laws virtually all the time. The only time things deviate from natural laws is when God is doing the odd miracle here and there, like parting the Red Sea, or changing water to wine, or raising himself from the dead. Here we see just a few examples of famous natural laws expressed as equations. Such as, we've got Newton's second law of motion, Einstein's relativity relationship, Newton's law of universal gravitation. Here we have Boltzmann's definition of entropy, mass action expression from chemistry, which governs equilibrium and chemical reactions. This one, a partial derivative here, is Le Chatelier's principle from chemistry. And then at the bottom, dS is greater than zero, is the second law of thermodynamics. Now, we could write dozens of major natural laws that have been discovered so far by humans in various fields of the physical and biological sciences. These statements of natural law are the ultimate triumphs and trophies of the scientific endeavor. And I think there's little doubt in this room tonight that God enjoys watching as humans discover his natural laws through scientific endeavor. He has seen to it that humans have powerful, incisive brains which can ask questions, design experiments, and use the scientific method to unravel the secrets of the universe. Every time humans discover a new law or a new principle or a new galaxy or a new fundamental particle, I suspect God is extraordinarily delighted. Over about 150 years of intense research, scientists using the brains that God caused to evolve have by now, in the year 2003, developed a fairly extensive explanation of how living things self-assemble through nothing more than the operation of God's natural laws. I'm going to say that again. We now understand, not completely, but pretty well, how living organisms arise through a self-assembly process, which is being driven by nothing other than a free-running operation of God's natural laws. I call the process God's automatic creature-generating machine. A good teacher will invent flashy names for things, so there it is. How many people here would be willing to, and I don't want to have a loud conversation with 2,000 people, but how many people here would be willing to try to learn from a person who has some expertise on the subject how God's creature-generating machine works? Can I see a show of hands? Who'd be willing to learn something about that? Okay. Who would not be willing to learn something about that? Anybody?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Someone is closed-minded and admits it. I applaud your candidness. Now, some of you may still be reticent to let me in, even for a trial run on evolution. You may be wondering if you will lose your faith if you even so much as entertain evolution. So maybe this will help a little. Can someone be both a Christian and an evolutionist at the same time? Of course they can. Two of the most famous evolutionists of all time were Christians. Here is George Lemaître, a Belgian Catholic physicist priest who galvanized cosmologists in 1927 by proposing that the universe began when a hot, dense primeval atom exploded, an idea which adumbrated the modern Big Bang Theory. He is considered to be the father of the Big Bang Theory. He was later decorated by the Pope for his scientific achievements. And here we have Theodosius Dobzhansky, one of the three greatest evolutionary theorists of the 20th century. He's famous for saying, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." As I pointed out, he was a Russian Orthodox Christian. Okay, now, what I'm going to do with my remaining time is attempt to explain how two of the most important developments in vertebrate evolution have occurred. I'm going to talk about the evolution of legs and the evolution of wings. And I'm lastly going to talk about what may be the most difficult to explain problem in all of organismal evolutionary biology, which is the evolution of birds in general. Okay, so here we go now. What do we mean when we say that living things have evolved? We mean that all living things are genetically related through a process of what Darwin called descent with modification from common ancestors. And here is what I call, when I teach it, the central mechanism of evolution. All right, here's how evolution works. This is God's automatic creature-making machine. Evolution always occurs in three steps. First, we have mutation to DNA, which can occur in a multitude of very well understood ways. Secondly, we have altered embryological development. It alters the way the organism develops as an embryo, right here, represented by these arrows. And the third step is always what Charles Darwin discovered, natural selection, where an environmental scenario must exist which naturally selects for, or at least does not select against, the new phenotype. Here's just a few slides showing the guy who figured out the third step. That's the one that we got first. Going back, historically, natural selection was figured out first. Voyage of the Beagle in 1831, Darwin sailed around the world, and then upon his return got married, had many children, and proceeded in 1859 to publish one of the most famous works in the entire history of science on the origin of species. Okay, the second part of the central mechanism that was discovered was mutation to DNA, discovery of the double helix, principles of genetics in the first part of the century by people like Thomas Hunt, Morgan, and so forth. That was what was worked out next. And it's only extremely recently, it's really only since 1984, that we have even begun to understand the third middle step. This is the one that we've never been able to explain until now. And this is why creationist objections to the theory are entirely reasonable, up to this point in time, I would say. So would you like to see the... So here's a picture of an embryo developing. And the third step, altered development, now being unraveled by many, many scientists around the world. A couple of things that you need to understand. One of my goals here is to help explain the theory itself. It's my contention that most creationists reject the theory because they don't really understand the theory. I would reject it, too, if I understood it the way creationists do. I really would, and I don't mean that as an insult. I used to be a creationist. I literally applaud you as creationists for not accepting the theory as you understand it. You've done a rational, reasonable thing. You've displayed your intelligence by doing that, as has Dr. Hovind, who's an extremely intelligent man. And
Matthew Rainbow has got to be the nicest, most sweetest, most sincere, beautiful man that I've ever seen Dr. Hovind debate. Wow. Such a wonderful, wonderful man. Now, this guy really is cool. So I hope you guys are enjoying this debate here. Again, you can send your questions right now or your comments or just your ideas over AOL Instant Messenger. Dr. Dino Live is our screen name. It's DrDinoLive. Let us know what you're thinking about this. I mean, this guy's pretty cool. He's an evolutionist, so he's wrong, but he's still pretty cool. I mean, he's respectful. So if you have any ideas, if you're enjoying this, write us now, Dr. Dino Live. Tell us what you're thinking.
Probably going to steamroll over me in the rest of this debate. But would you like to see the machine itself in operation? Okay. Well, sorry, you can't. Because the evolution machine operates continuously and seamlessly all around the planet, in every nook and cranny of the Earth's multitudinous environments, and it is also constantly operating genetically on the molecular and biochemical level inside the living cells of all the world's organisms. The machine is way too complicated to see in the true sense of the word. But you know what? I have created a special graphic which provides a simplified, highly schematic picture of the machine in operation. And I call it an evolutionary phase space diagram. Now, let me catch up here. What this is going to explain, what this explains, is the evolution of legs. We're trying to explain how you go from a lobe-finned fish here to an early amphibian. Lobe-finned fish here, going down, see his little legs there. I really wish it was darker in here. can we just turn the lights down a little bit? Okay, and we have a pretty good explanation, we think, of how this happened. We think that legs evolved underwater first, not on land. This is a creature called Acanthostega, long fish-like tail, totally fish-like body, but he had little tiny legs and toes, eight toes. Here's the actual fossil of Acanthostega. Here's what the skeleton looks like articulated. And we're pretty sure he lived underwater because he had a long fish-like tail that would have done him almost no good on land, crawling around down low to the ground. So now here's my picture of the evolution machine, God's creature-making machine, and how it works. Okay, so here's what's going on in this machine. Now, I know this is really small for most of you, but we'll do the best. I'm doing the best I can. What we have, this is a multivariable graph. That is not a valley.
All right, well, we have a break right now. Stay tuned. We're going to come back and pick up right where we left off. TruthRadio.com. We'll be right back.
you're like me, you believe the FBI has never apologized, never had any thoughts of regret about Ruby Ridge. Well, here's FBI negotiator Fred Lansley. Hear what he says.
We fouled up in front of the entire world, and it should never have happened. And I think it was just a really disappointing day for the FBI.
The FBI later admits to covering up facts during the court case, and the rules of engagement are deemed unconstitutional.
Well, the FBI may not have officially apologized for what went on at Ruby Ridge, but it was impressive to hear Fred Lansley speak out against his bosses. That's almost never done. This DVD, new to me, is really great. Lots of good background information about the Weaver case and Randy himself showing up and telling his story. You can have a copy if you write to me, P.O. Box 344, Nipomo, California, 93444.
When was the last time you had a quarrel with your mate?
With Moments Together, here's Dennis Rainey.
Conflict in the home is as normal as breathing, isn't it? Our aim shouldn't be to avoid it, but to handle it wisely. One reason why people have so much conflict in marriage is that opposites really do attract. In fact, it's not unusual to find a peacemaker married to a prizefighter. The peacemaker says, it's okay, but let's just forget it. It isn't worth the hassle. But the prizefighter, on the other hand, says, let's put on the gloves and let's duke it out. Well, there's a lot at stake in the way we handle conflict. It's not just the intimacy in your marriage that's on the line. Our children are learning how to resolve conflict by watching us. Are you a prize fighter or a peacemaker? Have you learned how to resolve conflict? It's possible when the Prince of Peace rules in your heart and in your home.
Moments Together with Dennis Rainey is made possible by Regal Books, the Moments Together devotional series at Christian bookstores or regalbooks.com.
All right, welcome back to the Creation Science Hour. That was my little personal intro music there. This is Jonathan Sampson. I just had a couple people here on Instant Messenger say, who are you? Never heard of you. Well, I've been here for 2 years on the radio. Anyway, that's okay. I got a face for radio. You guys will never forget my face. Let's see. We were just listening to a debate here between Dr. Matthew Rainbow, who is a biochemist professor over at Antelope Valley College. And he's debating our very own Dr. Ken Hovind, who's been running around the world, literally, speaking on creation, evolution, dinosaurs, and the Bible for well over 16 years. A long time. I was very young 16 years ago. Not in diapers, but probably just out of them. I don't know, around there somewhere. So without further ado, we got some questions here. They're saying, who is this guy? Well, this guy right here happens to be my most favorite evolutionist, Dr. Matthew Rainbow. He's a very nice guy, very open-minded, very, very truthful and honest. And he's going through and giving his little introduction spill on the evolutionary theory, what it is, and he's arguing from a position of a theistic evolutionist. He says evolution is true, but that's the way that God did it. And that should be the reason why we should elevate God even higher in our lives and say, wow. I mean, you built a machine that can build itself. And so that's his perspective here, which is wrong, but that's okay. He's very nice. So this is Dr. Matthew Rainbow. We're going to jump right back into it. AOL Instant Messenger, Dr. Dino Live is our screen name. Send your questions in right now, your ideas. I want to know what you guys think, because if you don't say anything, then I won't know if this is even fun, and then we just start reading, like, books on the air or something like that, and that would stink really bad. So these videos are fun. Let me know if you like them. Truthradio.com to tell your friends to tune in. Dr. Dino Live on AOL Instant Messenger.
Hey, it looks like a valley. It's not a valley. This is a three-dimensional graph in what I call phase space, evolutionary phase space, showing the how the machine creates organisms automatically. Here on this axis, we have the phenotypic axis. This is what the animals are like. Here we have the environmental axis, going in this case from water to land, deep ocean, coral reef, tide pool, shoreline, dry land. Here we're going from a ray-finned fish to a coelacanth to various lobe-finned fish, one of which here is Acanthostega, which I just showed you. Ichthyostega, a famous more advanced amphibian, and then finally Tularpaton here, which is a full-fledged land-going amphibian. So we're going again to give you the big picture from fins to legs here, and we're going from the deep ocean to the dry land here. Now the vertical axis represents decreasing fitness. So if you're high, you die. If you're low, you go. In other words, you live. If you're high, you die. You're up on what I call the peaks of death. And if you're down low in what I call the valley of survival, that means you are fit. You are well adapted to your environment. Now watch how this works. Let's say you're here in phase space. Can you do the three-dimensional math? Okay, what are you? You're a ray fin fish. Okay, you're a fish. Where are you? You're on dry land. So you are dead. You're a fish out of water, so you're dead. You are unfit for your environment. Let's do this one. What are you here? Follow it along. You're a full-fledged amphibian, but you're out in the deep blue sea. So you are dead. You are unfit. Let's do this one. What are you here? You're a ray fin fish in the deep ocean. You're beautifully adapted to your environment. And right here you'd be Tularpaton on dry land but near a tide pool. So you're doing pretty well here. You're well adapted to your environment. One more here, Acanthostega, that would be right here. You're a primitive amphibian living in a tide pool, trying to make a living in a coral reef. Now, how could he have done that? Let's explain this. Right here, why do we think legs might have evolved underwater? Well, here's the theory. If he was out, so mom here takes a mutation in her sperm or egg cells, and that's a critical point to remember. Let's get all this stuff up here. Okay, the mutations to DNA have to take place in sperm or egg cells, otherwise they won't make it into the next generation. Remember always that the new phenotype, the new form of animal, always shows up in junior, always shows up in the offspring, and then natural selection comes into play and has to select, if this is what we're trying to evolve, has to select for this and deselect for the old type of organism. Now in the deep blue sea, do you want to have legs and toes? No. See, he would be poorly adapted. He's dead out there. You want to have fins if you're in the deep blue sea, and that's why we still have fish with us today after 400 million years. If you're living 5 miles deep in the ocean, in pitch black water that's freezing cold, at pressures that are twice what crush our nuclear submarines, what do you want to be? You don't want to be a human. You better hope to God that you're a fish down there. Okay, but here in a coral reef, see the island and so forth? Here in a coral reef, what we think could have happened is this. If you're in a coral reef, there's powerful currents going back and forth. There's algae and so forth. And one thing that you can try to do is to carry out what we would call ambush predation. You remain hidden in the algae or behind rocks and things like that, and then you leap out suddenly with your still fish-like tail and catch fish. Now, you can see that if you're still a low-fin fish right here, he's going to have a little bit of a hard time carrying out ambush predation because there's powerful currents in a coral reef that are pushing him back and forth. And if he's trying to station keep in some algae, he would have to wave his fins and remain in one place, which is going to give away his location and scare the prey off. But look what he can do. He can do something that no animal has ever done before in evolution. He can hang on to things with his little legs and toes and remain perfectly motionless and then leap out and catch a fish. This is the theory for how Acanthostega may have been selected for and how legs evolved underwater. Okay, now here's an animation of that process. There's a constant chatter of mutation to DNA that's ceaselessly generating new forms of organisms. The environment is constantly changing here. This is constantly changing. Organisms are constantly migrating or getting blown into new environments. These are the random forces which drive evolution. But what happens next now, see, these are random forces. These are random mutations, totally random. Transposons are jumping around in the DNA, moving enhancers around and so forth and so on, creating chaos. Most of it's birth defects. Probably 99.9% of all the mutations are harmful. This is random events here in the environment, plate tectonics, climate, disease, drought, all kinds of things are taking place here. This is random. This is random. But what goes on now in the machine is anything but random. Evolution is not totally random. So let me now, and here, okay, I'm going to press on here and use even some of my time. Okay, now bear with me. I've got to bring up an animation.
It's a bit of a silence here. He's just trying to bring up this file right now on his computer, a very sleek, nice little Macintosh computer, and with a swivel head and everything. TruthRadio.com, if you want to tune in, I tell your friends to tune in. Dr. Dino live on AOL Instant Messenger, DrDinoLive.
Okay, we'll try to put this on the whole screen. Okay, and here's what takes place in phase space. Each little dot represents a species or an individual, either one. Organisms explore evolutionary phase space now in single-step mutations, and they do it with ruthless efficiency, like water exploring a canyon. So what's happening here is that we start off here with a fish in the deep blue sea, mutations take place, and then you go to the next phase here in the Valley of Survival. And now the numbers, since they're beautifully adapted, they build up. See, they build up in number there. So now you've got more of these guys, lobe fin fish. They build up. And then there are so many of them, there might be 10 million, 100 million lobe fin fish in the Pacific or something like that. And now you can do calculations and show that the probability of the next step, the probability of moving the right enhancer in front of the right homeotic homeobox gene or whatever, is not only possible, but it's inevitable. You can prove that it's inevitable that the next mutation will take place. And so now you get the next, you start to invade the next locus. The little yellow arrows represent mutations. So see, it just keeps building up, next mutation, building up, next mutation, building up, next mutation. And so the organisms are tracking or coursing their way through evolutionary phase space like water through a canyon. So what you want to think about as you look at this image is picture all these random events, the changes to the environment, and changes to the phenotypes of organisms as being kind of like a constant rain falling down on this whole phase space diagram. And just as rain would be channeled down into the channel or the valley and flow along, in a similar way, you see how natural selection, which is anything but random, channels the mutations very efficiently through phase space. Once in a while, you have a few organisms, see a few dots up here in the valleys, the foothills. They're just barely making it up there. They're not very well adapted. They don't survive very well. And up here in the taller mountains, nothing makes it up there. Okay, so the principles here are that the number of organisms at each locus in phase space builds up until the probability of the next step becomes inevitable. There's the principle that one step leads to another. By many small steps, you can climb a mountain, and by many small steps, a dramatic change in organisms can occur over evolutionary time.
Well, there we go. Turn off my car. Keep in mind out there, he just said small steps can climb a mountain, and small steps can also lead to some very dramatic evolutionary changes. The problem he has here is small steps climbing a mountain are always in one direction. You're going up that mountain. But evolution
does not, it doesn't claim to have that one direction change. You're not climbing a mountain, as evolutionists would say. The thing can go forward, backwards, left, right, diagonal, any way it can go. And that's not the type of changes we have. So we're going to jump back right back in there.
Notice that evolution leaves behind what I call a trail of ancestors. See, look at that trail of all the ancestors that are still there, still beautifully adapted to their respective environments. In my class, someone always asks me, Dr. Rainbow, if humans have evolved from apes, they always think humans have evolved from apes, which they haven't. We've evolved from ape-like creatures. But they say, if humans have evolved from apes, why are there still apes in Africa? I always get that question every semester. And you should be able to easily see now that that's an exceedingly silly question. That's no different than asking, why are there still fish 5 miles below the surface of the ocean? What's the answer? Because they're beautifully adapted to their environment. Another principle is that evolution is a blind, random, fluky process driven by random mutations to DNA and random changes to the environment. I already said that. The selection is anything but random. So in a supreme irony, this process, as I hope you may be able to see, even though it's driven by random processes, it ends up creating creatures that look just as if they'd been designed by a creator. Which they really have, haven't they? Because it's the creator who dictated Le Chatelier's principle and Coulomb's law and Newton's second law and the Schrodinger equation and all the laws that govern how the atoms and molecules self-assemble. So God still gets all the credit for this. In fact, he's an even more awesome God. Now, let me take stock of where I am. How many minutes over am I? Okay, I mean over my time. What? Oh, 5 minutes. Okay. Because I need to respect the interplay that you've all come to see. So
I'm going to have to cut it forward to Dr. Hoban's section here. We've already given him like an hour and 5 minutes. So I'm going to go ahead and hit forward real quick. Just go to Dr. Hoban's section.
Give me a second here to discuss.
Well, thank you so much for coming. This place is jammed. I don't know how many are in the hallway, but we have a lot of folks here tonight. It's an honor to be here. My name is Kent Hovind. I taught high school science 15 years, and now I travel and do seminars on creation, evolution, and dinosaurs. And I take the position the Bible is literally true and scientifically accurate. God made everything in 6 literal 24-hour days, and the evolution theory currently being taught in our schools is one of the dumbest and most dangerous religions in the history of humanity. That's my take on it, okay? People are welcome to believe all that stuff, but I don't think they should teach it at taxpayers' expense in public schools. That ought to be taught in private schools at, you know, personal expense. Okay, this is not my wife, just a picture. I have 3 kids, all married, and the dog died, so I made it. I'm home free. It's wonderful. And we have 2 grandkids and hopefully 20 more coming. Great. I have in my backyard Dinosaur Adventure Land. We like science. We like dinosaurs, but we think God ought to get the glory for his creation. If you get an opportunity to come to Dinosaur Adventure Land in Pensacola, Florida, we'd love to have you. You may also want to come to our first ever, and hopefully first annual, creation conference. We've had 25,000 visitors in the first 2 years at Dinosaur Adventureland. You guys need to start one out here. That would be great. We need to use science and creation to glorify God. This September is our creation conference. If you want to sign up, the folks at the table don't know about this, but there's supposed to be a list out there. I want to grab a notepad, Ken Andrew, and if anybody wants to sign up, we'll send you information if you're interested. Or just call my office and say, send me stuff on the creation conference if you want to come. Or better yet, come visit our ministry. We have about 40 people in our ministry. God's given us an awesome staff. And we try to use our efforts to build, produce materials that will strengthen your faith in the Word of God. Okay. Now, right here. What's the evidence for evolution? All the evidence that I have seen in my 30-some years of study.
Oh, we got to cut it off right there. We're going to break right now. Stay tuned. Tell your friends, truthradio.com.
thousands of people in Southeast Asia, December 26th will never be forgotten. The tsunami that hit 11 countries devastated millions of lives that will take decades to rebuild. Many of you have already donated money to help the needy. Lifeline, America's most trusted Christian telecom company, has another way for you to help. No, we're not asking for donations. We're simply asking you to take what you already use, internet service, and put your daily web surfing to work, changing lives. Call and switch to Lifeline Internet now. Get fast, filtered surfing for as little as $9.95 per month and help places such as Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand while the doors are open so wide. At Lifeline, we donate a portion of your internet bill to relief ministries that you choose, and we've been doing it for almost 15 years.
Phone 1-800-311-2418. Your participation with Lifeline will help Truth Radio.
Spectre promoted this trial, this UN trial of Saddam Hussein, for a specific purpose: to soften us up for the idea of having the International Criminal Court.
By January this year, in radio shows, I was warning people, this year it's terrorism. This year the issue will be terrorism, because the end goal is an international court of justice that will take away all criminal law jurisdiction in the guise or under the argument that you can't fight terrorism without a new international court of criminal justice. That's the end game.
They've just arrested over 500. 500 are being people. We don't know who they are. Are being held incognito, without a trial, without bond.
This is just simply imagination, or computer-generated graphics. Doesn't show it happened. That's, you know, how we think it might have happened. None of that is science, okay? Science is things we can observe and study and test and demonstrate. So what's the evidence for evolution? I happen to like science. I collect science books. I have hundreds of them. I taught the subject for 15 years. I really enjoy science. People say, there's evidence for evolution. Okay, I don't think so. We'll talk about that in a minute. And they say, couldn't God have used evolution to get us here? Well, we need to define some terms. There are six different meanings to the word evolution. I cover this in my seminar. First, there'd have to be cosmic evolution, the origin of time, space, matter. Where did that come from? Secondly, there'd have to be chemical evolution. If the Big Bang theory is true, the Big Bang produced hydrogen. You'll never hear them talk about this, but it had to happen because you have to somehow get uranium from hydrogen. That simply is not possible. Thirdly, there'd have to be stellar evolution. That's the origin of stars. Nobody's ever seen a star form. All we see are stars blow up. That's the opposite of evolution. There's novas or supernovas. We don't see them form. One professor I debated said, we're seeing a star form right now in Crab Nebula. I said, no, you're not. You're seeing a spot get brighter. And you're assuming it's a star forming. It could be the dust is clearing. There's already a star behind it. You don't know any stars are forming. What we do know, there's a lot of stars out there. There's enough that everybody on Earth can own 11 trillion of them to yourself. We've never seen one star form. But fourthly, we have what's called organic evolution, the origin of life. The evolutionist has a serious problem with this one, getting over going from non-living material to living organisms. Now, Dr. Rainbow and I talked before this debate, and we agreed we would only limit this discussion to, once life begins, how did it evolve? Okay, that's what we're going to talk about. I don't think there's any evidence for that either. But I think skipping the first four steps would be fatal for students to realize, to not realize these are essential steps the evolutionist is simply trying to avoid, because they don't have an answer for any of those. Lastly, or fifthly, we have what's called macroevolution. This is where an animal changes to a different kind of animal. Nobody has ever observed any of this. We never see a dog produce a non-dog. You may get a big dog or a little dog, but you're going to get a dog, and there are limits to these changes. Okay? You're never going to get a dog as big as Texas or a dog as small as a flea. There are limits. Sure, there are changes, but there are limits. And the further you get from the norm, the more problems you have. You start having hip dysplasia and disease resistance goes down and stuff like that. So the normal average generic mutt is probably where it started. And now all these special breeds we've created, like the Chihuahua, definitely swimming in the shallow end of the gene pool, are certainly basically useless in my book. But every kid knows that a dog, a wolf, and a coyote are the same kind of animal. We do this in churches. I get a five-year-old kid, and I'll say, which one of these is different, boys and girls? The dog, the wolf, the coyote, or the banana? They pick it out almost every time. One kid said, the boy. And, well, It's a banana. Okay. The Bible says the animals will bring forth after their kind. Now, Charlie Darwin wrote a book called The Origin of Species. The argument is not about the origin of species. The argument is about the origin of kinds. I'm not sure who's deciding when a new species has been created or not. You know, a dog and a wolf are different species, but they're obviously the same kind of animal. I'd like to meet the guy who's making the decision. This is a new species, okay? It's still the same kind. Lastly, we have what's called microevolution. I don't like the term. I think it's confusing. We should just call it a variation within the kind. But whatever you call it, number six happens. That one I agree with. All the first five are purely imagination. Students have to be taught to believe in these by computer animations or, you know, pictures of how it might have happened. It all takes place in the imagination. It never takes place in reality. People say, couldn't God use evolution to get us here? Well, that depends what you mean by God. The God that would use evolution is cruel, wasteful, stupid, he's deceitful, he's not the God of the Bible, that's for sure. It's not in the character of God to use misfits, blind chance, and death. My God gets it right first time. Doesn't have to practice, okay? Jacques Monod, a Nobel Prize winner, said, natural selection is the blindest, most cruel way of evolving new species and more complex and refined organisms. The struggle for life and elimination of the weakest is a horrible process against which the whole modern ethics revolts. An ideal society is a non-selective society, one where the weak is protected, which is exactly the opposite of the reverse of the so-called natural law. I'm surprised that a Christian would defend the idea that this is the process which God more or less set up in order to have evolution. I'm surprised also that Christians try to blend evolution with creation. David Hull, Northwest University, said, whatever the God implied by evolutionary theory and the data of natural selection may be like, he is not the Protestant God of waste not, want not. He is also not a loving God who cares about his production. He is not even the awful God portrayed in the book of Job. The God of Galapagos is careless, wasteful, indifferent, almost diabolical. He is certainly not the sort of God to whom anyone would be inclined to pray. Charlie Darwin said in his book, thus from the war of nature and famine and the death, the most exalted object we're capable of conceiving, the production of higher animals follows. Evolution is a religion of death and struggle and cruelty. It is not compatible with the scriptures. My Bible says God's work is perfect. He made it right first time. The God that would use evolution is deceitful. Not the God of the Bible. There's no evidence for evolution anyway. The Bible says God formed the world by his word. He spoke it into existence. He did it in 6 days. He told us clearly how he did it. He didn't use millions of years to get here. I think it'd be a retarded God that can't make it right first time. I wouldn't worship a God like that. Okay? It nullifies the need for the death of Christ by having God use this evolutionary process. And there is no evidence for evolution. So why would we compromise a perfectly good Bible, which has never been proven wrong, with a dumb theory that has never been proven right? I see no reason to compromise in this war. Okay. Are they the same? No. The Bible and evolution are absolutely backwards in every respect. We could spend an hour talking about this one. They're irreconcilably different. Evolution says death brought man into the world. The Bible says man brought death into the world. The differences are impossible to reconcile. Somebody is wrong. And I enjoy showing them who they are. Okay. Now, suppose I said, I have a theory that the moon is made of green cheese. Okay. It's okay to have a dumb theory. That's perfectly fine. Then, suppose I said, NASA proved it when they went there in 1973 on a secret mission. Well, it's okay to have a dumb theory, but it's not okay to use lies to support my theory. Right? It's even worse to use tax dollars to get paid while I lie to support my theory. So if there's evidence for evolution, I really want to see it. The textbook says, you're an animal and share a common heritage with earthworms. This is ludicrous, okay? If you want to believe your great-great-grandpa was a worm, you go ahead and believe that, but don't use my tax dollars to teach that to my kids, okay? You go teach that to your kids at your religious school. Now, they say they have evidence for evolution. They say they have evidence from fossils. I'm telling you, folks, in a court of law, fossils wouldn't hold up 1 second as evidence. You bring in your bones and say, these bones are the ancestors of us today. They're going to laugh at you and say, Your Honor, he can't prove those bones had any kids. He sure can't prove they had different kids. Absolutely no fossils could possibly count in this discussion. When you find fossils in the dirt, all you know is it died. So don't tell me fossils are evidence for evolution. They talk about the fossil record. I say, hold it, first place, there is no fossil record. There are a bunch of bones in the dirt. It's not a record, okay? There aren't dates on them. There are just a bunch of bones in the dirt. It's just as much evidence for a flood. They say they have evidence from structure, evidence from molecular biology, evidence from development, like you talked about tonight. Well, we can talk about some of those as quick as we can. The textbooks start off with the assumption that the universe is billions of years old and started with the Big Bang. I think that theory is ludicrous and has been proven wrong years ago. That's not science. We cover that in great detail on our video number one out there on the table, if you want to get one of those. There's not many left. Sorry about that. But they tell the Earth, they can tell the kids that radioactive dating proves things are millions of years old. That is also not evidence for evolution. Radioactive dating is ridiculous. We cover that thoroughly on video seven. There's an example where living snails were carbon dated 27,000 years old. They're still alive, okay? That's 1984. I give many examples on video number seven about that. This guy said, in the last 2 years, an absolute date has been obtained for the Gandon bed. It has the interesting value of 300,000 years, plus or minus 300,000 years. Well, they nailed that one right on the head, didn't they? Anyway, get video seven if you want more on carbon dating or potassium-argon dating or uranium-lead dating. I got them all on video seven. So they tell the kids the Earth is billions of years old. That is not evidence for evolution. Even if the Earth were billions of years old, there's still no evidence for evolution. And I think there's ample evidence the Earth is not billions of years old, and we cover that on video number one of our series. They tell the kids the Earth started off hot and it slowly cooled down. Yet the Bible says the Earth was created underwater. It was never a hot molten mass. The scientific evidence points to the fact that the Bible is right, because all over the world, radiopolonium halos are found. Very short half-life on polonium-218 and 214, like down to, you know, less than 3 minutes. And you get the book, you go to halos.com if you want a whole lot more on the radiopolonium halos. They prove positively the Earth was never a hot molten mass. Cover that on video seven. Textbook says the stalactites form slowly, very slowly, tiny drops of water. That is not evidence for evolution. Not evidence for anything. It's not even true. Here's me standing by a stalagmite. It's only 100 years old in Thermopolis, Wyoming. Okay, it happens very quickly. This is not a stalagmite, actually. This is a flowstone formation from simply minerals in mineral water being pumped out of a pipe. The Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and by one man, sin came into the world, and death by sin. Yet Darwin said, death brought man into the world. Somebody's wrong, folks. Did man bring death into the world, or did death bring man into the world? Don't try to compromise the two. Get on or get off. Somebody's wrong, okay? Book says, this is Grandpa. 30 million years ago, larger primates, such as monkeys and apes, evolved. They are ancestral to both humans and modern apes. Look, you're welcome to believe that. But that's not science. Not observable science, that's for sure. That's not Grandpa. Okay. Now, all of the so-called evidence for evolution from the cavemen that I'm aware of, and I've studied it real actively now for 30-some years, all of it has been discredited. I mean, you pick your caveman, Homo erectus, Java man, Piltdown man, Lucy, they've all been discredited. This article in the newspaper says, he's the daddy of us all. This is silly. You don't know he's the daddy of anybody. All you know is he found some bones in the dirt. That's all you know. You can't prove he had any kids that lived. Don't tell me he's the daddy of us all. They're lying to you, okay? Cover much more on the caveman in video number two. They tell us dinosaurs lived millions of years ago. That is simply not true. There's ample evidence dinosaurs have always lived with man. We cover that for 2 hours, for 2.5 hours on our video number three. Textbook says the Colorado River cut the Grand Canyon slowly over millions of years. That's ludicrous. The top of Grand Canyon is higher than both ends. Rivers don't flow uphill. Grand Canyon's a washed-out spillway. Anybody that studies it will know that. I flew down it 2 days ago coming here, looking, took a bunch of pictures flying down across the Grand Canyon. It's a one-mile rise spread out over 270 miles, so you don't notice it much. But it's not formed by the Colorado River. The textbooks tell the kids each of the layers of rock is a different age. The whole geologic column is baloney. It doesn't exist any place on Earth except the textbooks. There is no geologic column. This guy admits it. He said if there were a column of sediments, unfortunately, no such column exists. It's a great theory, but it's not science. It's not observable. You can have all the theories you want, but I want to, where's the beef? Where's the evidence, okay? All over the world, petrified trees are found standing up, connecting these layers. Now, here they are telling us these layers are different ages, and yet we got petrified trees connecting them. They're not different ages, folks. They all formed in one big flood in the days of Noah. We cover that on video number four about the geologic column. Okay. Textbook says the Devonian period is characterized by the lobe-finned fish, like we heard about tonight. Well, they say this is proof of evolution, that it slowly evolved from fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals. Just memorize the word farm, and you got it. F-A-R-M, fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals. This is what they imagine it might have happened like, but it is pure imagination. And the lobe-finned fish are still very much alive. When they found the coelacanth swimming around the Indian Ocean back in 1938, they brought one into the scientists and they said, wow, look at this. They survived for 300 million years. Never dawned on them one time to question the theory. because the theory is sacred. The evidence must fit the theory. Now, see the way science is supposed to work. You get a theory, you check the evidence. If the evidence says, nope, the theory's not right, you throw the theory away. You get a new theory. That's the way it's supposed to work. And it does work that way in science with everything except this evolution theory. And I think I know why. I think it's because the only alternative to evolution is creation. And if creation is true, then there's a creator. And if there's a creator, there might be some rules. You mean like, thou shalt not? Ooh, we don't want those rules. So we're going to deny the creator. That's really what it boils down to in every instance. The lobe-finned fish is still alive. The textbooks tell the kids, you can tell the evidence for evolution because of the similar four-limb structures. This one says, these homologous structures provide evidence that these animals evolved from a common ancestor. And they show the two bones in the wrist of all kinds of different animals. This is silly. The textbook says, comparative anatomy provides further evidence of evolution. The commonality suggests these and other vertebrate animals are all related. They probably evolved from a common ancestor. That is ludicrous. They probably have a common designer is why they're similar. The different bones develop from different genes on the chromosomes. And even if they were coming from the same genes on the chromosomes and they're not, that still wouldn't be evidence for evolution. It could be evidence for a common designer. And they're so complex, complex things don't happen automatically. Somebody has to create them. You know, doing an imagination, a computer animation of how it might have happened, that's not science. That's imagination. The lug nuts from a Pontiac will fit on a Chevy.
Hey, we're going to put it right there. You guys check out drdenner.com. Check out the article, How to Get Saved. Hopefully we'll finish this again on Monday, maybe. If Dr. Hogan's not back by then. All right, God bless. Thanks for tuning in.
One of the greatest helpers for Truth Radio in the past has been those of you who have signed up for Lifeline telephone service, long-distance service and local service, internet service, and now the Lifeline company, Lifeline Communications, is offering service through T-Mobile. If you have a cell phone or if you would like to have a cell phone service that really works and has really modern, neat equipment and a great approach to this whole business of cell phone, and you want to help Truth Radio at the same time, then may I recommend that you call 800, that's 800-311-2418, that's 800-311-2418. And tell them that you want to sign up for T-Mobile through Lifeline. Phone 1-800-311-2418. Your participation with Lifeline will help Truth Radio. 800-311-2418.
Nice touch.
Thank you, dear. Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Do you love me?
Do I love you?
Yeah.
You mean right this minute? Well, hang on.
What?
Let's see. Lunch tomorrow looks like a bologna sandwich on white bread.
Lunch tomorrow?
And it doesn't look like you've done the laundry yet. Well, when you're using that fabric softener I don't like. And my shirts aren't pressed.
Bob, I just want to know if you love me.
Well, I'd say right now, including this lovely dinner, my love for you is lukewarm.
Lukewarm?
Oh, it's a solid 3 out of 10, and I'm sure it'll be higher after you do the laundry.
After I do? Bob, you don't love me. You just love the things I do for you.
Do you love God for who he is? Or is your love for him dependent on what he does for you? A message from Lifeline Productions. 1-800-52-FUNNY. At lifelinepro.com.
Not arrogant enough to call Truth Radio the home of the truth, because the home of the truth is up there with the Lord in heaven.